Yes?
Do we have like a tentative outline of topics?
Well, so I was going... What?
Or can we vote? Or,
actually, as a matter of fact, I would be very curious to hear what you guys want to hear about. But I was going to do over the next today and maybe finishing tomorrow, covered what I consider to be the most interesting Grand Unified theories. And then next week is so the Grand Unified theories do a great job of unifying the. What they really do a great job of is explaining, you know, putting the standard model gauge group into a single unified gauge group with just a single gauge coupling, and then at the same time unifying all of the fermions of one generation into a single irreducible representation, or in any case into a conceptually more satisfying unit. So then next week, there are a couple of different things. I was going to talk about the ideas about how to, you know, one thing that has been less successful, but there have been some interesting ideas put forward, is how to explain where the three generations come from, how to mix that in with the story. I was going to talk about also attempts to unify not just the fermions with one another, but the fermions with the Higgs boson, or the fermions with the gauge, or the fermions with the bosons, or the gauge bosons with the Higgs boson. There are various other ideas about how to attempt other unification schemes, and none of them rise to the same level of striking beauty. I hope you'll see. So to the thing we'll talk, the grand unification, if I do this any justice, it'll be a very fun lecture because, it's kind of like, in the same sense that the strong CP problem, the fact that you seem to be able to write down this term in the standard model Lagrangian, but then experimentally you don't see it. In the same sense that seems like a very clear hint about something that we don't understand that goes beyond our current understanding of the standard model, but that's an experimental hint. But it's something we don't understand. It's very unlikely to be a coincidence. So grand unification, there's a part of it that kind of works well and a part that doesn't work well. But the part that does work well it's kind of has a similar status, I would say. It's not clear we know what the meaning of this hint is, but there's a theoretical hint about the structure of the standard model Lagrangian that seems very likely to be a clue about something beyond the standard model and likely to not just be a coincidence. And so, next week it was gonna be more of I'm still trying to figure out how to fit it in the most efficient manner, but it was gonna be a attempt to introduce you to a whole bunch of miscellaneous ideas about how to resolve various of the other puzzles in the standard model, all of which have problems. Grand unification has problems too, but so they're all bits and pieces of a puzzle that hasn't been put together properly. But so I was also gonna talk a little bit about prion models. I was gonna talk about left-right symmetric models, which are one elegant way of solving I was gonna review the strong CP problem and a couple of the most promising solutions to it. So it's a little bit more of a miscellaneous, attempts to fit in as many miscellaneous topics in a coherent fashion as possible. Definitely I do. I mean, if any of you guys have particular things you want to hear about, then you should let me know, either by email or by now, by speaking up right now, or at any time. Anyway, okay, yeah, is that... You'll tell me after class what you want to hear about. I know you will. Grand unification. Grand unified theories. Well, so, you know, the idea back in the 70s was people wrote down the standard model finally, and they were very excited about it, and they realized, that what was going on is that it seemed to be that the real symmetry of nature was this bigger symmetry. But because of the spontaneous breaking of that symmetry by the Higgs, at low energies, it looks like the universe is described by a theory with some lower, smaller symmetry. So it was natural. It was natural to wonder. Well, could this also be the result of some symmetry breaking process, so that actually the real theory has even more symmetry than this? And in the process, could there be some bigger gauge group that this is contained in the same way that this is contained in that guy, that would unify things more and hopefully explain some of the unexplained features of this model? In a brief burst in the mid-70s, people found what are really the most interesting examples of that, continue to be the most interesting examples of that. As I was saying a few minutes ago, there's two aspects of those theories, if you want. So there's the part which is sort of undeniable, which is that it's just a mathematical fact that when you reinterpret the representation of the fermions in the standard model, when you reinterpret them in terms of certain higher dimensional groups, as representations of certain higher dimensional groups, that you get a much more elegant picture of where the apparently weird pattern of charges and hypercharges here come from, and why the list of standard model particles is what it is, why the anomalies cancel, et cetera. That is just clearly like a mathematical fact that seems, well, for it's a mathematical fact, and furthermore, it seems it's pretty hard to believe once you've seen it that it's just will turn out to be purely a coincidence. Now, then there's a separate question of what the physical interpretation of that fact is. The interpretation that people had in mind in the 1970s, and mostly have had in mind since then, is that, just like this and this were described by four-dimensional Yang-Mills theories, that this unification process would also be described, that this bigger thing would also be a four-dimensional Yang-Mills theory, and that has led to some problems there that we'll review. And so I think it's much less clear that that is the correct physical interpretation of what this mathematical fact about the group theory is saying. But so today I really just want to begin by describing. There's really three cases I want to explain, and they're really all related to each other, and so I want to explain their relation also. But so we have SU5, SO10, and so-called Patti Salam, or SU4 times SU2 times SU2. And really, you can think of this is kind of the governing one, and then these are two different intermediate patterns through which this guy can break down on its way down to the standard model. So I want to begin by just explaining from a group theoretic standpoint what is interesting about those, and then we can say something about what is good or bad about their actual implementations as grand unified theories in the sense of 4D gauge theories. Okay. So actually, I'm going to erase this and draw my table. Okay, so I'm going to switch. So if we take our usual table here of the standard model particles, which now we want to get a deeper understanding of. Quark, the right-handed up quark, the right-handed down quark, the left-handed lepton, the right-handed neutrino, the right-handed electron, and those are the fermions, and then we have the Higgs boson. Okay, and as usual, we have this table is filled in some way. Okay. Okay, so for the purposes of what I'm about to say, I just want to begin by rewriting this in a new notation. Okay, so let's forget for a moment about the fact that, so for example, this guy. This is an object. This is a collection of complex numbers, i.e. a vector space. This lives in, this guy over each point in space-time is valued in a vector space. And that vector space has a tensor product structure. In other words, this is a tensor and it carries different indices. So in particular, it carries an SU3 index, it carries an SU2 index, and it carries a left-handed spinner index. Okay. Let's forget for the time being about its spinner index. Let's just forget about that. But let's write the vector space in which it lives. So if you forget for a moment about the spinner structure of the field and just focus on its internal structure, this thing lives in a vector space which is, I'm going to write it this way. Okay, I'm going to write it as C3. Because it has a color index times C2, tensor product with C2, tensor product with C1/6. Okay, so let me just to make sure that we understand what we're talking about here. Let me just first remind you. So recall what a tensor product means. So C3, okay, that's a shorthand notation for the vector space of three component complex vectors. And so it has, let's say, three basis elements, V1, V2, and V3. And a vector in this vector space is an arbitrary complex number times this vector, this basis element, plus an arbitrary complex number times this one, plus an arbitrary complex number times this one. Okay, fine. So, and then C2 is a two-component complex vector space, meaning that it has some other basis elements, W1 and W2, and an arbitrary vector in this vector space is a complex number times this guy, plus a complex number times this guy. And then the definition of the vector space C3 tensor C2 is, well, now this is the base. This is the vector space where the basis elements are the tensor product of any two guys here. So the basis elements here are V1 tensor W1, and then a second basis element is V1 tensor W2, and then there's six in total. So there's V2 tensor W1, V2 tensor W2, V3 tensor W1, V3 tensor W2. So this space has 3 times 2 equals 6 basis elements, and an arbitrary element in this vector space is an arbitrary complex linear combination of any of those 6 basis elements. Okay, this is the tensor product over C. Okay, so that's what the tensor product means. Now, if you think about it, that means that if I take the tensor product with a one-dimensional vector space here, this is C to the 1. I haven't, you know, if I don't write anything, I just mean the one-dimensional vector space that's just isomorphic to the complex numbers. This is redundant, really. This doesn't add any new basis elements to the vector space. There's just one basis element here, but that's equivalent to saying that this thing is indistinguishable from the field on the field C, which acts on these as a scalar on these vectors. Okay, so this is just a notational thing. I just want to write in this other form, have a way of writing what the SU3. I mean, these two parts are actually the vector space on which the thing acts is this thing, but I'll always write it in this tensor product of three components, because I'm really trying to write down for you three elements of this table, but in a way that'll be more useful to us in a moment. Okay, so Q left lives in that vector space. Now, there's one other thing I wanna I want to do. I want to change notation here. So far, I have been taking the normalization of the hypercharges to be the historical one. In other words, for the right-handed particles, the hypercharge is the same as the electric charge, and historically, the electric charge of the electron is minus one. And so we're all used, physicists are used to thinking in that language, that the electron has charge minus one, and from that standpoint, the quarks have only a fraction of that charge, minus one-third or two-thirds. Okay, but there's a more mathematically natural normalization for these charges, which is physically completely equivalent, which is that, you know, I can just multiply all of these charges by an arbitrary number, and that will make no physical effect in my theory. I can always accommodate that by just normalizing down the U1 gauge coupling by the inverse amount. And so what I want to do is I want to multiply all these charges through by 6 to turn them all into integers. Okay, so if I do that, that'll be more convenient for what we're about to say. This will become charge 1. 2 times 2/3 times 6 is 4. Minus 1/3 times 6 is minus 2. Minus 1/2 times 6 is minus 3. Minus 1 times 6 is minus 6. And 1/2 times 6 is 3. Okay, so in that language, this guy I'll call C1. Okay, so then you write transforms like C3 tensor C, because it doesn't transform under SU2. So that's just the trivial one-component vector space again, which is only here for notational purposes. I could just erase it if I wanted. And then times another C4. In other words, the subscript here, again, doesn't denote the dimension. Is that clear? It denotes the hypercharge. I'm imagining that the hypercharge, when it acts, SU3 when it acts, it rotates this part of the vector space. SU2 when it acts rotates this part, and U1 when it acts multiplies this last part by an overall complex phase. Okay, D right. Transforms this C3 times C again, because it doesn't transform under SU2, times C minus 2. The left-handed lepton transforms. Now it doesn't transform under color. It does transform as a doublet under SU2, and its hypercharge is minus 3. New right transforms under nothing, so it's just C times C times C with hypercharge 0, and E right doesn't transform under SU3, doesn't transform under SU2, but does transform under U1 with charge minus 6. Okay, great. So those are the particles. Now there's the corresponding antiparticles. I'll just write down one I'm going to want them later, so I am going to write down. So the corresponding antiparticles to these fields transform as the dual or the conjugate representation. So they transform as, I'll write that as 3C3 star. So in other words, if this one transforms, if this vector transforms under SU3 transformation as V goes to UV, where U is the SU3 vector, then this one goes to U dagger, transforms with U dagger. So this guy will write as C3 star, tensor C2 star, and then because we're taking the complex conjugate here, this becomes C minus one. If this one gets multiplied by a certain phase, this one gets multiplied by the opposite phase. Okay, let me just try to write as fast as I can. Unfortunately, I'm kind of slow at writing on the board. We'll need this in a minute, so. be minus 4 now. D right. Transforms with U1 charge plus 2. L left antiparticle transforms under C, tensor C 2 star. Tensor, I'm leaving, you know, if it's just this trivial factor C, I'm just leaving it alone. Now it has hypercharge plus 3. New right star is again trivial under everything. And E right star. Like so. Okay. So those are the the representation of the particles and antiparticles in the standard model is the direct sum of all of these vector spaces. So this plus this plus this plus this, direct sum with this, et cetera. And so we can organize that into the following form. We can take all of the left-handed fields. So that guy is left-handed. This guy is right-handed, so it's antiparticle. Transforms as a left chiral spinner. So this is left-handed, this is left-handed. This guy is left-handed, and these two are right-handed, so it's their antiparticles that are left-handed. Okay. So F, let's say F is the direct sum of those six pieces. So I'm not going to write it up here, but I just this and then plus this, plus this, plus this. Okay, and then F star is the conjugate or dual of that. All these other bits added together, direct summed with each other. Okay, so that is the representation space on which the standard model acts. And now, so we want to see if we can understand that. You know, the thing that was realized in the 70s was that you could understand that representation space more beautifully as coming from a representation of SU5. And in fact, this is not how, the way I'll describe it here is not how people originally understood it in the 70s. It's gotten nicer over time. People have understood it better. But this is the gist. So we want to somehow think of the standard model gauge group as embedded in SU5. Okay, so how can that go? SU5 is the set of unitary 5x5 matrices. Okay. So we want to have a map from let's say we have an element U3, a 3x3 unitary matrix in SU3. And an element of SU2, which I'll call the 2x2 unitary matrix, which I'll call U2. And then here, U1 is just a group of complex phases. So let this be some complex phase alpha. So in other words, alpha is some e to the I phi, just a complex phase. We want some map of that into a 5x5 unitary matrix. So that the mapping gives a subgroup of SU5. Well, so you know, we need, because this is just a product of three groups, these groups don't talk to each other. So U2, the action of U2 in the standard model commutes with U3. They don't know about one another. So these groups all have to commute with each other. And so to get the U2 and U3 part to commute, we have to put them somewhere in this 5x5 matrix. Well, we really only have, you know, it's pretty clear what we have to do. We have to put the U2 in one block and the U3 in another block. So in other words, we have, this is a 5x5 matrix, and I'm saying the upper 2x2 block is where we put the U. The lower 3x3 block is where we put U3. Okay, so far so good. Then when we act with this matrix, the U2 part and the U3 part will not commute with each other. They'll because they're acting on different subspaces. Let's say this acts on a 5-component vector. This guy is always going to act, just mix up the top 2 components. This guy's always just going to mix up the bottom 3 components. So they're totally independent of each other. And then what about this U1? How can we embed it? Again, it has to commute with both this and this. So, you know, the only thing that will commute through this part, through an arbitrary 2x2 unitary matrix, the only matrix that will commute with that is a 2x2 identity matrix. And same thing down here. The only thing that will commute, the only 3x3 matrix that will commute with an arbitrary 3x3 unitary is the 3x3 unitary matrix, the 3x3 unit matrix. Okay, so in other words, I want to embed U1 as, so let me, U1, it's going to have to be alpha to some power here times the 2x2 unit matrix, the 2x2 identity matrix, I'll call that I2, times alpha to some other power down here, Q, times the 3x3 identity matrix. That's going to be has to be how we represent alpha. But then this whole thing has to be an element of SU5. So the determinant has to be 1. So the determinant will be the product, will be alpha to the p. The determinant will be alpha. You know, if you think about this, this is a diagonal matrix. Alpha to the p, alpha to the p, alpha to the q, alpha to the q, alpha to the q. So alpha to the 2p plus alpha to the 3q, sorry, times alpha to the 3q has to be 1. That's the determinant of that matrix. So in other words, alpha, so you get a ratio between p and q from this equation. So the simplest way to write a matrix satisfying that equation is to say this is alpha 3 times alpha to the minus 2. Okay, you could arbitrarily scale either of these, but so that this is, again, that's related to the fact that you can, this is going to be related to the fact that you can arbitrarily multiply these charges by a constant without really changing anything. But this is, we're going to try to write this in the simplest way where everything is integers. So okay, so that's the representation of U1. So in other words, over here I have an alpha to the 3 in front and an alpha to the minus 2 in front here. This is just an overall alpha times the identity matrix multiplying this matrix. Okay, so that's going to be my representation. So for every element of the group of the form U3 comma U2 comma alpha, I'm going to represent it as a 5x5 matrix like that. And that represents, that correctly represents the standard model, because now all the elements commute, and they've all been fit into a 5x5 unitary determinant 1 matrix. Okay, so far so good. So now the first thing to say is that, well, so have we precisely represented this group? Well, not quite, because the mapping here is not one-to-one, because if you think about it, there are non-trivial elements in this group that are getting mapped to the identity matrix here. So in particular, imagine that U2, imagine that we chose the matrix U2 here to be alpha to the minus 3 times the 2x2 identity matrix, and we chose the matrix U3 to be alpha squared times the 3x3 identity matrix. okay, well, this is a unitary matrix, so it has to have determinant 1. So the determinant of this matrix would be alpha to the minus, this is a 2 by 2 diagonal matrix with alpha to the minus 3 and alpha to the minus 3. So alpha to the minus 6 is the determinant, that has to be 1. And same thing here. This is only a unitary matrix if the determinant, which in this case is alpha squared times alpha squared times alpha squared, which is alpha to the 6, is 1. Okay, so alpha has to be a sixth root of unity. So alpha is of the form 2 pi pi some integer m over 6. But if I take any sixth root of unity and plug in u2 and u3 in this form, then I find that this matrix, just the representation, the SU5 representation of that, reduces to the identity. So that means that secretly, if this SU5 scheme is going to work, it's saying that secretly the standard model gauge group is not what we thought it was, but it's actually really the standard model gauge group is SU3 times SU2 times U1 mod Z6. Okay, so let's see, does that make sense actually? Uh-oh, what did I do? What does arbitrary scroll mean? Oh, I see. I see, so the middle board can go up, but it can't come any further down. Okay, so, well, does that make sense? Is it really the case that the standard model gauge group is really that factor, that quotient group? Well, let's check. If that's the case, then it should be the case that in our representation table here, actually, if we think about it, that if we take that particular non-trivial element of SU3 times SU2 times U1 and act on any particular field in our table, that actually the action should be trivial. You know, does that work? So let's look at Q left as an example. So how would it transform? Well, it transforms under SU3, so it picks up a factor of alpha squared. So in other words, is it clear what I'm doing? I wanna now take the element. I want to take the element of SU3 times SU2 times U1 of the form alpha squared times the 3 by 3 identity times alpha to the minus 3 times the 2 by 2 identity times alpha as my U1 element. So this is an element of the group. SU3 times SU2 times U1. And I want to see, is it true that this thing always acts trivially on the fields in the standard model? So if we act on Q left, well, from the action of this matrix acts on Q left, we get a factor of alpha squared. This matrix acts on Q left, we get a factor of alpha to the minus 3. And then this has, according to that table, charge 1, hypercharge 1, so that means that alpha to the 1 acts here. So that's alpha to the 0. So far, so good. What about U right? Let's try the next element in the table. Well, it transforms under SU3 again, so we get a factor, it transforms with a factor of alpha squared. It doesn't transform under SU2, so this matrix doesn't act on it. But it does transform under U1 with charge 4, so we get alpha to the 4, which gives alpha to the 6th. But again, the non-trivial element that we want to vanish is where alpha is a sixth root of unity. So actually this is again alpha to the, this is again equal to one. Okay, so far so good. So if you check every element in the table, indeed it is the case that everything in the standard model does transform trivially under this Z6 subgroup of that group. So the real, it appears to be the case that SU5 has, trying to embed the standard model into SU5 has led us to notice something about the standard model gauge group that we had previously missed. We thought we were constructing a gauge theory with this gauge group, but actually the standard model is really appears to have that gauge group. Okay, so far so good. That sounds like a nice hint. So now the basic point that I want to explain in the remainder of the lecture is that if we take SU5, SU5 acts in a certain way on the exterior algebra lambda C5, the exterior algebra built from C5, the vector space C5. So I'll have to just quickly review for you what that is, so you can see how this thing acts on it. And then what we want to see is that this is a very natural object, if you want, associated with SU5. And what we want to see is that if you look at how this vector space, the exterior algebra of C5, how it transforms under the subgroup that we just described, this subgroup here, where we, instead of acting with an arbitrary SU5 matrix, we act with this 2x2 and 3x3 block diagonal thing. We want to see that this exactly breaks down to F plus F star, the exact complicated representation of the standard model that we've been working with all along. Okay, so insofar as this is a much more natural and unified object, if you want, this is the first example of how you get a nicer explanation of where the weird pattern of charges, representations, and hypercharges in the standard model comes from. Okay. But so maybe we should, maybe it's a 1 minute break time. Now, to just state my feeling again, my feeling was that there was a burbling up of joke momentum and that there's some of that steam has been released now and that no one is going to offer a joke today. But I am happy to be proven wrong with that. Okay,
I can go again.
Oh, go, please. That's wonderful.
Did you hear that 9 was murdered the other day?
The what?
9 was murdered the other day.
I didn't hear that.
7 is the prime suspect.
That is another, obviously you should be ashamed of yourself, but also proud of yourself. So that's a great joke. It's a great joke. Is what I'm trying to say. It's exactly what we needed at this point. Okay. Yes?
Okay. So, first one is, should we not have expected this about G right from the start? Because we're dealing with projective representations.
That there should be a factor by something?
Well, that's the factor that's going to make everything projective.
Expected it? I don't know. Let's put it this way. You certainly could write down, a consistent anomaly-free gauge theory of the standard model where the group is this instead of the quotient group. And so it's not, you couldn't, I don't think we could have derived a priori that the group had this form. Now, is there some sense in which,
I mean, if you're changing the fields by an SU3 transformation, and the two SU3 transformations differ by an overall phase, then you haven't changed the fields at all in between those two.
Well, that would be true only if you knew, you know, that would be true if every field had an SU3 and an SU2 acting on it. That would be true. You know, but you know, the point is that you have a whole different, you have a whole bunch of different fields with you know, different combinations of SU3 and SU2 and U1 acting on them.
So like,
and that's the other thing, is that it's certainly important that, yeah.
If you had an SU2, like, let's go simpler, if you had an SU2 gauge theory.
I'll give you an example. So, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, if you had an SU2 gauge theory, I mean, why would you, I mean, I feel like you wouldn't have, like, the SU, it doesn't make sense to talk about the SU2, it makes sense to talk about SU2 mod C2, because if you change the field by that, you know, if you flip every field with a minus sign, it's the same field when you take inner products and stuff like this, right? Like, isn't every action a projective action? In field theory?
Well, so, let's see. So in, So again, so first of all, here what we're talking about is that the actual fields themselves transform trivially. I mean, it's true that if you write down, if you assume that every term in the Lagrangian is a pairing of two fields that transform under it, under such and such a thing, then indeed a minus one always acts trivially on that. But even there, you can have terms that, you know, we don't have these in the standard model, but you could, for example, under SU3, another invariant of SU3, for example, or another invariant of SUn is where you take the epsilon tensor and contract, you know, n fields with that. So there the corresponding phase that would make that trivial would be an nth root of unity. But you're saying that's why we have a third root of unity here and a second root of unity here.
Even in like rote modality, they write SU3 mod Z3 cross SU2 mod Z2 for this reason.
Say it again?
In Road to Reality, for example, they write SU3 mod Z3 cross SU2 mod Z2 for this reason, because all actions are supposed to be projective to begin with.
But like if you chose a different, say if QL was transformed under a different representation of U1, it wouldn't work.
I mean, so somehow it's clearly related to the fact here that the U1 charges are all, you know, related by a factor of 6. So if you took it's related to charge quantization. In other words, you can write down anomaly-free gauge theory. I mean, a famous puzzle is that you can write down consistent anomaly-free gauge theories where the charges are not all related by some simple rational numbers, the U1 charges. And the fact that they are in the standard model is charge quantization. And that needs some explanation. SU5 is one example of an explanation for that. But you can write consistent theories that don't have that property, in which case they wouldn't have this symmetry. I don't think. Well, let's talk more about it afterwards. I mean, I don't think it's true, but. And I think the fact that there's a U1 running around is key to why it's not true. But you're making me worry, so let's talk about it afterwards. I might be wrong. I mean, yeah. Certainly people were excited by one of the things that excited them about SU5 was that it gave this explanation for charge quantization. Anyway, let's talk more afterwards. Let me continue for the time being. I see, but so I can't put, okay, but I can do this. So we talked about what a tensor product of two vector spaces is. Now, there's another vector space that we could be interested in. Instead of taking the instead of just looking at the tensor product of let's say so C5, let's say that's our vector space that we're interested in. Instead of taking the tensor product of that with itself, we can take the space, the vector space of two forms in C5. Okay, so what is that? Well, that's a subspace of the space of C5, tensor C5. It's the anti-symmetric subspace. So if we took C5 tensor C5, that would be, and we took as a basis for C5 V1 through V5, then the basis for C5 tensor C5, like we were just saying, consists of all elements of the form basis 1 tensor basis vector 2. So there's 5 times 5 equals 25 of those. So that's a 25-dimensional space. But now, suppose we only look at the let's focus on the subspace of guys of basis elements of the form VI tensor VJ minus VJ tensor VI. In other words, the antisymmetric basis vectors in the tensor product space. And so we'll call this VI wedge VJ. So lambda 2 C5 is the vector space where you take complex, an arbitrary complex number times each basis element of this form. So how many of these are there? Well, these two things have to be different. So we have 5 choose 2 is 10 options here. So this is some 10-dimensional subspace of this 25-dimensional space. And so similarly, lambda 3 of C5 would be, now we would choose 3 tuples, make them antisymmetric. 3 tuples of basis elements, make them antisymmetric. Look at the vector, look at the subspace of, so this is the subspace of C tensor C, of C5 tensor C5 tensor C5. Okay, so that would normally be a 125-dimensional vector space where we took all triples of elements as the basis vectors. But now if we look for the totally antisymmetric pieces, the three guys all have to be different. So we're looking at 5 choose 3. So again we end up with a 10-dimensional vector space if you work that out. Okay, and so then the exterior algebra associated with C5 is just the sum of all of these forms. Okay, so lambda 0, the 0 forms, well, that's just the trivial vector space proportional to C. But then plus lambda 1 of C5, well, that's really just, here we're anti-symmetrizing over only one basis vector, so the anti-symmetrization does nothing. This is really just, this part is just isomorphic to C5. Plus lambda 2 C5, that's what we just talked about here. That's this 10-dimensional component. Plus lambda 3 C5. Plus lambda 4 C5. Plus lambda 5. C5. Okay, now here, this is the vector space whose basis is all antisymmetric combinations of all 5 of the generators. Well, there's only one you can write down. I mean, V1 wedge V2 wedge V3 wedge V4 wedge V5. We're not allowed to repeat any of the basis vectors, or else the antisymmetry will make that basis vector vanish. And we don't have anything more than V1 through V5 to play with. So this is the only basis vector for this component of the vector space. And for the same reason, we can't go further. There's no such thing as a lambda 6 C5, because there's no way to take an antisymmetric wedge product of 6 with 6 elements built from only the 5 basis vectors V1 through V5, because you'd always have to repeat at least one. So these are the only options available to us. And as we just described, this has dimension 5 choose 0, which is 1, 5 choose 1, which is 5, 5 choose 2, which is 10, 5 choose 3, which is 10, 5 choose 4, which is 5 again, and 5 choose 5, which is 1. So this total vector space has dimension, so this is, of course, just the coefficients in the binomial expansion. And for 5, their sum is 2 to the 5. 1 plus 5 plus 10 is 16, plus another 16 is 32, equals 2 to the 5. Okay, now if we look at, if we count up the dimensions of the fermionic Hilbert space there, you'll see that that is 32. Okay, so that's just as a first check that my goal here now is to quickly explain to you why it is that if you just look at this vector space, the exterior algebra, this is called an exterior algebra because this is not just a vector space, it's an algebra. You can take products of a vector here and a vector here to get a vector here, or you can take a product, the product just being the wedge product. So for example, the product of any two vectors, any two one-forms here is a two-form when you wedge them together, et cetera. So it's an algebra called the exterior algebra. It's the, if you want, the canonical algebra associated with C5. And what we want to argue is that that algebra, if you look how it transforms under SU5, and then you look at its breakdown to SU3 times SU2, we want to argue that this is the same as the standard model representation we wrote down on the top board there. And so at the first, we should just check that they actually have the same dimension. So we just said this guy has dimension 32. Here, if you count it up, so let's count up the dimensions in the left-hand column for the particles there. So the top one has dimension 3 times 2 equals 6, plus 1 times 2 is 2, plus 1 plus 1. So 6 plus 3 plus 3 is 12. Those are the first three rows. And then 2 plus 1 plus 1 is 4. Those are the last three rows. 12 plus 4 is 16. So that's, so one generation of fermions is 16-dimensional. The corresponding antifermions are another 16-dimensional. So indeed, this is also 32-dimensional. So far, so good. Yikes. Okay, so now there's one little bit, so it'll now be easy to see why this breaks up under SU3 times SU2 times U1 into this, provided I review one bit of group theory for you, which is that, okay, so remember we're dealing with unitary matrices. So unitary matrices, we're dealing with elements of SUN. Okay. So these are matrices, n by n matrices, that satisfy two conditions. One is that the u dagger u is equal to 1. Or if we phrase that in terms of components, that says u dagger ij times ujk is equal to delta ik. And then we have determinant of u is equal to 1. So if we phrase that in terms of components, that's, we take the antisymmetric tensor epsilon 1 through epsilon I1 through epsilon IN, the totally antisymmetric tensor with n indices, and contract that with u I1 times u I2 et cetera, up to u IN n is equal to 1. But then, if you just imagine flipping anything here, flipping any of these terms because of the antisymmetry of this guy, that's equivalent to saying that epsilon I1 dot 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 up to IN times u I1 J1 dot 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 up to u IN JN is equal to epsilon J1 up to JN. Okay, and so now, but now suppose we can take this identity and we can contract any of the hanging indices on this side with an appropriate U dagger. So, for example, let's move one And in that way, we can move a U, we can move these as many of these U's as we want to the other side and turn them into U daggers. So for example, suppose we multiply both sides of this by, so imagine we multiply here by U dagger Jn Kn. And similarly, we multiply on this side, we contract this side with U dagger Jn Kn. Okay, then what will happen? You know, if you think about it, this U dagger times this last U will give a delta I K because of that identity. And so this will, okay, and so we'll end up removing the IN in favor of a KN, but then let's just change it to not go crazy. Let's just change it back to an IN. When we write the answer. So for example, just moving one guy over, we get that U J1 I1 up to U Jn minus 1 In minus 1 is equal to epsilon J1 through Jn times U dagger Jn In. Okay, so that's the sort of thing we can do, and it's clear how it keeps going. We can just keep moving U's over according to this pattern. Okay, so the point about that is that now, suppose we consider, for example, how C, you know, so on C5, U acts in the natural way. So if we have an element, let's call it phi I, a five component vector in C5, it transforms to Uij phi j. Okay, the natural matrix action of the unitary matrix on that. Okay, so now if we have an element, for example, of lambda 2 C5, well, now that, if we write that in component notation like this, well, that's a tensor with two indices, because remember it lives in this space where the bases are v1, vi, tensor vj, but then anti-symmetrized. So this is a tensor with two indices, but it's an anti-symmetric tensor under permutation of those indices. So this thing transforms like uik ujl phi kl. So this is a 10-dimensional, you know, it turns out, I won't show this here, but it turns out that each of these components, so the zero index tensor, the one index tensor, the two index antisymmetric tensor, the three index antisymmetric tensor, four index antisymmetric tensor, and five index antisymmetric tensor, they all transform like irreducible representations of SU5 with these dimensions. And what I want to show here is that the representation the representation under which lambda n transforms, okay, with basically n u's acting, so that's a completely antisymmetric tensor with n indices. That transforms with n u's here. That's equivalent to the transformation law for an element of lambda 5 minus n. Star. Okay, so in other words, I'm trying to say this guy. And this guy is the same, is isomorphic to the star of this representation. This guy is isomorphic to the star of this representation. This guy is isomorphic to the star of this representation. So you can, well, maybe due to lack of time, let me just say oh, you know what? I'm going to screw up the whole. This is, again, a lesson from learned earlier in the course. I'm going to take the first 5 minutes of the next class to show that the representation breaks down this way before moving on to SO10 and Patty Salam. But the basic point is that these identities you can use to show that these two representations are isomorphic to each other. And once you have that in hand, it's just a short calculation to show that this becomes this. But let me do that at the beginning of the next lecture rather than rush through it now. Okay.